From the fields of the antebellum South to the boardrooms of corporate America, the story of African-American women at work is one of the great untold narratives. It's a story of perseverance against the successive evils of slavery and bigotry, and it is a story of individual triumph and collective solidarity achieved against enormous odds. Above all, it is a vital chapter in American history. One that is still being written, and one whose meaning is essential to all who would understand where we come from and where we may be going. My guest today is Sharon Harley, editor of Sister Circle, Black Women and Work, and associate professor in the Afro-American Studies program at the University of Maryland. Sharon Harley, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
Now, Sharon, the origin of this work, like the phrase Sister Circle, is intriguing. And so let's begin right there. I think it begins, does it not, with a group of young African-American women scholars who are sort of curious about work as a phenomenon in their own lives and as a phenomenon in the lives of other African-American women. Is that correct?
Well, that actually was a kind of a second motivation for the project and the book's title. But initially it started with a potluck dinner at my house. In which we all got in a circle, thus the Sister Circle title. And in the process of each introduction, we were shocked and amazed to learn that 18 of the 21 women there was doing a research project on women's work broadly defined. And we said we should continue to meet and talk about this work. And 5 years later, 6 years later, we edited Sister Circle, Black Women in Work.
Yeah. How would you characterize this, Sharon? This is a, you know, it's a fascinating sort of taking of an experience, collective experience of a group of women, and then with the result of a book. But the book's undertaken with what precise idea in mind? I mean, what were you attempting to do?
Well, initially we were attempting to just meet once a month in a research seminar to share ideas, get input from different scholars. What's special and unique about the project and the book itself is that it's interdisciplinary. So there are historians, literary scholars, legal scholars, anthropologists, historians. So I think what's what makes the book particularly compelling to people is that it's interdisciplinary and that we discussed our ideas over many years, and we have these really well-written, fine-tuned essays that reflect our original research interests, but also the input from scholars from different disciplines.
Yeah, we're going to turn to those essays in some significant number in the course of our conversation. But I move to ask you another question just occurred to me. Is using the symbol of the circle, is the idea of this book, in a sense, to widen the circle, to bring others into this discussion? And the reason I think that occurs to me is that you use the word interactive. It is highly interactive. It's interactive not just between the writers and their subjects, but also in a time sense, historical sense, it's interactive. So I'm just wondering, is it written as much to provoke discussion as to bring understanding?
Well, that's a very perceptive analysis because it was interactive on many, many levels. One is that we interacted with each other. But we so enjoyed the experience and how enriching it was that throughout every year we met, we'd always have a public forum. So we may have met in four or five different public arenas and opened up the discussion to people in the audience. So it was interactive in that sense. We wanted to be interactive because we wanted to go beyond the traditional scholar in the field to engage the thinking and the share the readership with book clubs, and so it was interactive, you know, in that sense. So we really did not want to write the traditional scholarly text that may have a very small and very narrowly focused audience. We wanted a range of people to read the book. And then finally, I think we thought that it might provoke either some controversy, but certainly some conversation.
Right. And well, let's look at some of these chapters and some of these essays. Let's start right at the start, right at the beginning, very colorfully named first chapter, Work It Sister, which has to do with the workplace itself, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
Like what goes on.
And we deliberately chose the kind of what would not be a traditional scholarly title because we wanted to bring in a new audience or enlarge our readership beyond the university. and to the book club readership, and maybe thinking Oprah Winfrey might even pick up this book. Well,
that's the way to do it. You catch people's attention. There's
exactly,
no question about it.
Exactly.
And another thing that catches people's attention is the very first essay, Tanya Lavelle Banks. And she goes into territory that's both interesting and challenging. I mean, talking about the way in which, quote, physical appearance standards act as a barrier to Black women in the workplace. I mean, the classic example is brought forth in this, her essay, for cornrows and braids, for example, for women who are in corporate positions and then being censored by those corporations for having that. And that, you know, it raises an extraordinary range of issues. One of them, Sharon, that occurred to me is that the lack of seemingly effective legal recourse for women caught up in that bind.
Well, Tanya Banks is one of the two legal scholars in the group, a distinguished law professor at the University of Maryland. And here again, she suggests the complexity of Black women's work lives. It isn't one in which they're defined by either just gender or by racial identity, but how physical appearance, and this, of course, runs across racial lines.
Right.
And so she's looking at what happens in a workplace in which people, in particular Black women, are discouraged from wearing cornrows. And then she moves, quite interestingly, to another issue which has not been addressed, but which several of our essays look at, and that's the whole issue of skin color difference in African-American communities and the implications.
Colorism.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so it's not just about gender or race, but it is, unfortunately, often about one's physical appearance.
Yeah. I thought it was really provocative because, as you say, it did go from related to very obviously related subjects, but colorism, that is to say the hierarchy of color tones within the Black community, has been kind of a, I would classify it as an embarrassment, quite frankly, historically,
yes,
within the Black community, not much talked about.
Yeah. It certainly has been pretty taboo, except for in a few scholarly examinations, probably more prevalent in literary representations, novels, and short stories, but if we're serious about examining Black women's work, we cannot overlook this as an issue in how Black women live their lives. And as it turns out, what's particularly provocative about this essay, it involves two African-American women in a legal battle because one alleges that the other was unkind and mistreated her and didn't support her because of the difference in their skin color tones. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite interesting. The one who sues uses the legal cases that were used and the law that was used to prevent racial discrimination. She uses it to say that she was discriminated against because of her skin color by another African-American woman who was her boss.
Bonnie Thornton Dill and Talise Johnson, in their joint essay, their jointly written essay, introduce us to the plight of poor Black women in the Mississippi Delta. And plight, I think, is the right word, because these women are uneducated, subject to all sorts of coercion, including sexual coercion. The stories, however, do suggest to me, Sharon, that, well, first of all, they're evocative as to how important the family is, how important some sense of community is. Did you get that impression?
Very much so. And I think what they address is a number of stereotypes about welfare recipients. We just have gross and unfair generalizations about welfare recipients. So she does a series of interviews and oral histories and case studies looking at welfare recipients in the rural community, because we often think about welfare recipients as being urban-based, but she looks at them in rural Mississippi and looks at the ways in which, like the other women we have examined in the book, how they employ various strategies to overcome their struggle and how it's not a question of welfare versus wage work. Often they have jobs, but they're low-income jobs, they're seasonal jobs, and they use welfare as a supplement. This was a very timely essay because as she was writing it, it was amidst of various pieces of legislation about welfare and from welfare to work, which needs a whole other series of essays.
Yeah. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA. And my guest is Sharon Harley, editor of Sister Circle, Black Women and Work. Let's talk about your own essay. This is really, it's not just because you're present company, but it's one of my favorites. It's The Other Path. These are women who worked in the underground economy of the early 20th century, the underground economy, to be candid here, in, as bootleggers, as numbers backers, and in the institution of the business of prostitution. And the subject is the very colorful, very successful Odessa Marie Madre. Tell people what she did.
Well, she was a very successful numbers backer. That's sort of the legal betting on numbers pre-legal lotteries. And she ran various gambling dens. She sold bootleg liquor. And she also had a house of ill repute, which, you know, was involving prostitution. But she was so successful at it that she was known often as the Al Capone of Washington, D.C. And this was a kind of a job or a work area in which males had dominated. So mm-hmm. she was very unique, not only in that she was a successful businesswoman in these enterprises, but that she was sort of at the top of the game, as it were.
Right.
And she's a very, very fascinating woman. Here, I want somebody to do a screenplay, because she's a fascinating woman. I mean, you would think a woman who was smart, who had gone mm-hmm. to the very prestigious Dunbar High School, came from a family with property and some business background and professional family members, that she would have gone on, like many Dunbar graduates, to teach, and that was the occupation that was mainly available and only available, the only occupation that black women could have a professional position was as teachers. But she didn't want to be a teacher. And through a whole series of fascinations with the life of the kind of the fast life that she was around her in the neighborhood where she grew up, she became interested in having a kind of her own business, gambling and the like.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned earlier, she remembered her days at Dunbar as being particularly painful. She was a darker-skinned African-American woman, and she remembered being teased, not only because of her skin color, but also because she herself says, I wasn't particularly attractive. And so she used the money she probably got from her parents. She used her own bravado and sense of mm-hmm. herself. And courageously went into a field that she found both exciting and lucrative.
Yeah. And she had to, in doing that and being successful at it, and she had counterparts in other cities.
Sure.
And one thinks, New Orleans and, right. and even the North, Detroit and so forth. But you had to be tough mm-hmm. and you had to be a first-rate executive. Right. There's no question about it. What is also interesting about her, and this is, I don't know the answer to this question, of course, but I think this might be very, very intriguing. What was her relation, Sharon, with the larger community? Because now here you have a successful woman doing the demi-monde, you know, the tenderloin, the other side of the street, but doing it very, very successfully. What's the effect of that on the larger community?
Well, that's a good question. I think if we put it in the context of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, I would think that she had a relationship with the business community because, like many other people in this line of work, she had a legitimate business,
right.
which was a nightclub called Club Madre, where Count Basie and Joe Louis and other moms, maybe, frequent her nightclub. And so she obviously had some relationship with that element of the black community. She had contact with poor working class black families in her neighborhood because she often gave them money. I think her relationship with the black professional elite was maybe the more strained of those relationships because while people understood that in many cases this was the only way black people could make money and poor ethnic communities could make money, I think that people probably of the most religiously conservative African Americans and the black professional elite, she may not have been looked at in the most positive light.
Yeah. Those, well, men and women alike in this sense, I'm thinking back to my own time in Buffalo, New York, and the numbers runners who were often the richest people around and the toughest, and ended up being, in a kind of behind-the-scenes way, the go-to guys for a lot of things that were done, but not brought up front.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I wasn't reluctant to write this essay because I wanted to write about all aspects of African-American women's work. But there was some concern expressed when the seminar met and I presented my essay. Mm-hmm. Because people were concerned about what were the implications of writing about a woman like this. Would people see African-American people in a negative light, you know, make gross generalizations? And I didn't feel the same concern that other people had because I knew there were people like Odessa Madri in many communities, and they weren't all African-American people. But oftentimes, these were the people who behind the scenes supported civil rights struggles, political struggles. They were the ones who would put money in the church basket. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who often would send people off to college. And when I have presented my essay in the book to a public audience and I talk about the reluctance and the concern I have about writing about a person like this, several people, including people in the seminar, came up to me afterwards and said, "Oh, I went to Harvard and my grandmother ran a numbers game and I bought my books at Harvard from the money my grandmother sent to me."
The next essay I want to cite is a personal heartbreaker. And I think you pointed out quite rightly at the beginning, these are stories of triumph on many levels, and yet there is a great sadness that people even had to contend against these things. Francile Roussan, is it? Wilson?
Roussan
Wilson's poignant essay on Sadie Moselle Alexander. Sadie Moselle Alexander is the first black woman to achieve a doctorate in economics in 1921. I think it was from University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But in any event, and here's what's important, racism and sexism combine to keep her from using it. I think she ends up gets a law degree after that, I think, and works for her husband. Mm. This has to be a devastating comment on racism, because, I mean, here you have someone who's done it all and yet can't do any of it, not allowed to do any of it.
Yeah, she received her PhD from the Wharton School in economics and can't find a job in her field. In fact, one of her professors at the Wharton School was so upset about this that he refused to recommend any of his students to the firms that refused to hire her. And she ended up working as an actuary at the black-owned North Carolina Mutual Insurance Association. And then she comes back and gets a law degree, and no law firm would pick up this very smart person with this very prestigious degree. So she ends up working in her husband's law firm, but not in the big lucrative cases. She ends up, not surprisingly, working in the domestic arena, family, divorce cases and the like. But George, you'll be happy to know that in this essay and in a larger essay for a new book we're working on, Professor Wilson talks about how Sadie reconstructed herself as the woman of the year and would promote herself, probably because people never fully recognized her for her professional attributes. And so she would position herself in photographs and at forums as the first of everything. And you'd also, I think, be happy to know that there's a large picture of her at the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
All right.
So she is finally getting her due, but she was not overwrought by her failure to get her rightful professional place. She promoted herself and considered herself on par with the giants wherever. And Professor Wilson has a photographic talk that she does of images of Sadie Alexander, where Sadie positions herself always in the center and the front, even dresses in a way that would draw attention to her. And she had a certain picture that she would use to promote the youthful Sadie Alexander. So I think this essay underscores what we're trying to say throughout the book, is that these women had various challenges, mm-hmm. but they develop strategies to try to address them.
Well, she might be the most colorful example of all, but the qualities you've suggested, that you've outlined for her, must have been to some degree part of all of them. I mean, these are strong people. Right. They don't quit.
Right.
Deborah Willis acquaints us with the difficulties faced by black women artists. And this is a vast topic, but given the constraints of time, let me see if I can target a question that'll get at least one aspect of it out. When I think of black artists in general and black women artists in particular, whatever the field may be, it occurs to me that one of the pillars of segregation, certainly of slavery, of segregation, bigotry, has been to deny intellectual activity, and of which artistic expression is, one of the most exquisite aspects. Which seems to me that the path of the black woman artist must have been an especially hard one.
I think that is true. I think what Debbie Willis, and she's just a very distinguished scholar of black photography and a MacArthur Award recipient. And, mm-hmm. She does several things for this book. She not only brings her own experience as an artist, as a noted photographer, but as a scholar of the field. And it has been particularly difficult, and has been difficult by what we described earlier, the issue of racism and sexism and the like. It's also been difficult not only because there's often not been an avenue for black women artists to have their work presented to museums and the like, but also what Debbie does is look at the images of mm-hmm. black women, often negative, stereotypical, and she offers a kind of critical analysis of what those images represent.
Right.
And the like. So it's a multifaceted aspect of looking at visual representation.
And when you put it that way, it reminds us on how many fronts the battles are waged.
Right.
I mean, it's not just to get the jobs, it's what you're thought of, mm-hmm. As well as what you have to fight to be allowed to do. If the artistic realm faced its special constraints, Sharon, I'm wondering, at some risk at asking this because I don't know, but I'm wondering if the religious arena is a freer form. Mm-hmm. And I'm moved to say that because Judy Moore Latta, and colorfully titled When the Spirits Takes Hold, What the Work Becomes, introduces Sister Leona Davis and Donna Sam's Hart to us, women who are gospel singers, evangelists, and educators. And I've just always had a perception of the church. I guess it was the church, a place where you could express yourself, move ahead, and realize yourself in ways that might have been easier than elsewhere.
Well, you could realize yourself, but you couldn't try to be the minister.
Well, that's right, too.
You could realize yourself, but you probably couldn't be on the policy-making mm-hmm. trustee board mm-hmm. until very, very recently. This is a wonderful piece because it underscores several things about the book. That work isn't just about wage work. Mm-hmm. One of the ways in which black women have engaged in work for many centuries is in their community work, particularly in the church. So this essay suggests that we clearly see work in a non-wage-earning capacity. And these women were spiritual workers. Mm-hmm. They worked not only to finance the church, but also do this very important spiritual work of the community. I think it's particularly salient for African-American communities to look at church women in their work lives. And I think you're right. It has, even though the women don't often occupy the leadership positions, but it does empower them to mm-hmm. get out and be in the public arena. Mm-hmm.
Well, Sharon, it's a remarkable book, and as we conclude this conversation, the obvious question is, where do we go from here? What is ahead of us? You mentioned earlier you are currently at work on the very next book. You know, I move to reflect that these are extraordinary times we're in. We have, I think, more than one black woman who's the CEO of a Fortune 500 company these days, which is extraordinary in itself. But at the same time, of course, we have situations in our inner cities that are keeping young African-American women from even dreaming of that. This is the age of globalization relating to the world at large. And I'm just wondering, what's your sense of has the challenge to black women changed because of all these factors, or does what has been true remain true?
I think it's just shifted. I think several things. One is, yes, where do we go from here? Mm. I actually am now hitting a seminar like this one on work and lives of women of color, in which I have seminar participants who do research and who themselves are Native American, African American, Latino, Asian American, a Caribbeanist, and a white woman who writes about white and Afro-Cuban women. Mm-hmm. So our next book will look at that. But right. I also am developing a project on African and women's labor studies in which I am trying to address some of the issues you've raised. I'm trying to develop projects in which I go to various communities, often working class or poor communities, and describe the lives of successful black women entrepreneurs historically and in a contemporary context, so as to show young people how what values these people represent, the skills and strategies they use to succeed. Because I don't think personally it's enough to have a CEO of a Fortune 500 company or two or three. And if there's so much poverty and disparity in various communities. So my vision is that I'll have a project, actually I'm writing proposals this week, to get foundation support for various projects in which I take the strength that's represented in these essays and share them with not just the book clubs, but with youth groups and family groups throughout poor neighborhoods to say these people overcame these obstacles, they needed these skills, and then have a way to teach those skills. Right. But in the global context, those skills have to be taught with computers and various forms of technology. Yeah. But we got to combine kind of a value system and technical skills, I would think.
I think that's true, and I think it's another example of combining the theoretical and the practical, the scholarly and the nitty-gritty. Thank you so much for being with us, Sharon Harley.
It's been my pleasure.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Sharon Harley, associate professor in the African American Studies program at the University of Maryland and editor of Sister Circle, Black Women and Work. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our production assistant is Megan Conway. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.